for the New York Institute for the Humanities at NYU, I'm Eric Banks. Vivian Gornick is the author of several books, including the celebrated memoir Fierce Attachments, The Odd Woman in the City, a finalist for the MBCC Award in Autobiography, and the essay collections The End of the Novel of Love and The Men in My Life, both of which were nominated for the National Book Critics Circle Award for Criticism. She has been a fellow of the NYIH for many years. Her new book is titled Unfinished Business, Notes of a Chronic Rereader, which is being published by FSG. All right, thank you for coming, and congratulations on the new book.
Oh, thanks a lot.
It's wonderful. You begin the book by writing, it has often been my experience that rereading a book that was important to me at earlier times in my life is something like lying on the analyst's couch. The narrative I've had by heart for years is suddenly being called into alarming question.
Yeah.
I'm wondering what motivated you to take on this particular concern, what it means to reread, and what rereading has meant to you personally at this point in your career. Is this a question that has occupied you for some time?
No, actually. The experience, of course, has occupied me for some time. But no, actually, I came to write this book because of a clever editor, my editor at FSG, Eileen Smith. I happened to reread E.M. Forster's Howards End. I can't remember when it was, a couple of years ago now. Mm-hmm. A friend of mine asked me to reread it with her. I hadn't read it since college, and I reread the book and was shocked at how different it looked to me. So I wrote that up in a small piece that the New York Times published, and then Eileen said, this is a book. Sit down and write it. I hadn't really thought of it, but once she suggested that, it took hold, and I became hooked on the idea of rereading and seeing where it took me.
Yeah. What was your reaction to the Forster? That's not one of the figures in the book. I don't believe he comes up.
No, he doesn't actually. That beginning, though, comes from that piece.
Uh-huh.
It's often been my experience that rereading, and it's really true. I remember everything wrong. It was set in 1890. I thought it was 1920. What? It's in Rome. I thought it was New York. It was that kind of thing. A lot of that. And yet, you find that the book still holds you.
Yeah.
And then you have to ask yourself why.
Yeah, it's weird the things that stick with you. I remember the Schlegel sisters so clearly.
Oh, yes.
And I remember the lost umbrella episode very clearly. There's a lot that I don't remember so clearly about that.
There were
book.
A lot of details I got wrong. But the thing that shocked me the most was, as I said in that original piece, when I was young and I read it, it seemed very mysterious to me.
Mm-hmm.
And I got into the drama and the poetry and the melancholy of the mystery, as young people do. Now I read it, and it did not seem mysterious to me. I thought I knew what it was all about and what he was all about, and it touched me just as much.
Mm-hmm.
So I had to describe that differently, and that's what the piece was about.
Yeah. Was there one thing that most surprised you in the different encounters you have with your previous reading self in the book, that you, in the process of writing it, that most shocked you, I guess, that you were most surprised to find out about yourself?
Oh, in the book, well, the Lawrence part, Sons and Lovers, which I once read aloud at the Institute,
mm-hmm.
that was the book that delivered the big, and Colette, actually, I guess Colette administered the most dramatic change of heart in me. And as I said, I could not, when I was 23 years old, she was the world to us, and she was like Tolstoy.
Mm-hmm.
We thought, everything she had made of a woman in love, the equal of God and man, or War and Peace. And now you read it and you think, what young woman today could read her as I read her? Nobody.
Yeah.
The question answers itself. And when I was young and read her, she made of that question of the great passion, sexual passion in a woman's life. She made of it a great drama. She made it mythic. She made it poetic. She made it have immense weight. Well, it doesn't. So we've all lived long enough now. And the thing that's really shocking is no young woman would subscribe to that today.
Yeah.
No matter what they feel.
When you, taking Colette as an example, when you plunged back into these books that had meant so much to you at different periods in your life.
Yeah.
Did you go in expecting to be disappointed by a Colette? Did you?
Never.
Was it really a somewhat shocking experience?
Absolutely. Always. Every one of these were books that I loved, treasured, that nourished me for long, long periods of time, and I expected to experience the same thing. I reread them in order to feel as nourished as I did before, until it became interesting that I was reading them differently.
And then were you able to sort of slog your way through, if that were the case?
Yeah.
You didn't just give up and throw it across the room.
Well, once I had another frame of reference, once it became interesting to me, examples of something I was devoted to, then it was sort of exciting.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't get depressed. I got excited when I saw the difference between then and now.
When you were organizing the book, when you were first beginning, did you have a set of had you already sort of isolated a set of people you wanted to look at
and
books that you wanted to go into?
No, that was actually a good part. I did these books intuitively. When I came to the end of one, I let some kind of a transition develop in my head about what would be good next. And that's how I operated. So that, for instance, after Lawrence, it was very natural to go to Colette. And from Colette to Marguerite Duras was no problem, no stretch at all. Then I was finished with that. And then the next most subtle version of this question of love and feelings was Elizabeth Bowen. And it just went like that.
Mm-hmm.
There were moments when I simply knew I wanted to include something, and then I found a way to fit it in, like the Delmore Schwartz and A.B. Yeshua part.
Which is incredible. I think that was especially interesting because I think you don't expect to come out of that chapter the way that you do. There's an appreciation that's really like hard won.
Thank you.
And very deserved.
Worked hard on that one.
Well, and I think it's also really impressive that there's a nice mix of authors who are in translation and authors whose language is English.
Yeah.
It's a very Catholic set of tastes, I think.
Although
one of the things I was going to ask you about, the books that you come back to look at again, and I think there are a lot of reasons for this, they do tend to be books that have a real emotional heft. There's very little comedy, and there's very... I don't really see it. I mean, except for maybe particularly Cats, which I don't think sounds like a very humorous book
No. No, I'm an earnest girl. I always have been. I've been accused of having no sense of play or fun all my life.
Well, that's not true. When I've gone back and reread books of comedy that were important to me, I find it a horrifying experience.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Why?
I mean, it doesn't even really matter if it's high comedy or if it's a particular kind of literary comedy, but they just don't hold up.
They don't hold up.
Diary of a Nobody is about the only one I know that always delivers.
I don't know
this,
that book. George
Grossman.
Oh, George Grossman.
Yeah.
Oh.
It really does work.
Yeah.
And I know a couple of other people have had that experience with
it.
But other things, and it doesn't matter. It really doesn't matter if it's Confederacy of Dunces or if it's John Waters collected essays. It's like there's something funny about the way that comedy doesn't quite.
It's very
work
temporal.
The same way.
It's comedy like movies are incredibly of their moment. I've been wanting for years to reread Out of Sheer Rage, but I've been afraid to.
Uh-huh.
A book I loved deeply, as many people have. But I'll give it a shot.
I did reread that, and it does still work.
Oh, is it? Make you laugh?
Yeah, it does still work.
Yeah.
Partly, I think, because of the talk you gave at the Institute a few years ago.
Mm-hmm.
When I read the unfinished part of the title, as a reminder of how much reading a book is not a singular experience, and it is a singular experience, but there is this relay over time. So you experience it multiple times. But it's put me in mind of an essay. You cited it when you gave your talk, Calvino's essay, Why Read the Classics.
Mm.
And I kept thinking about a couple of things that he had to say in relation to the book. One of his quotes, which I think you may have used, was a classic is a book that has never finished saying what it has to say.
I actually wanted to call my book that. They wouldn't let me.
They wouldn't let you?
No.
Why not?
I don't know. Too long or I don't know what. But I thought that was the right title.
It might be funny on Amazon. I don't know. Although whenever you Googled Calvino, that would pop up. This is
yes,
a selling point.
Certainly. It's a great sentence.
But then he also says, every rereading of a classic is as much a voyage of discovery as the first reading. And I was kind of curious how you would react to that.
Yeah.
How much of that holds true for you in the experience of writing this
book? Oh, yeah. I hope my book demonstrates that. Nothing could be truer. I'm now starting to write an essay on a book or a set of books that I read many years ago, and suddenly got hooked on all over again. And that's the two-volume autobiography of Storm Jameson.
Hmm.
English writer who was very well known in the first part of the 20th century, long fallen into this something or other. Storm Jameson wrote 45 novels, most of them mediocre. And when she was 70 years old, she sat down and started to write this autobiography, this memoir. It's a two-volume memoir. And it's a masterpiece. It's a marvelous book. I mean, she does in this everything that she couldn't do in the novels. And I wanted to write about how the meaning of every writer having only one genre that they can excel in. And she lived long enough to discover that she could do this, but she didn't discover it, but the readers have discovered it. It was the same with Edmund Gosse. He wrote poetry, Victorian poetry, which is nothing, and then Father and Son, which is a masterpiece.
Yeah.
So I'm reading this book for the third time, this Journey from the North, and again, I pick up things that I didn't remember at all. It isn't that what I do remember of what I read before is not true, but it feels so much thicker now. There are so many things I look at now in that book that I just never registered or I forgot. I forgot the tone, the texture, the feel of it, how that feel got developed in the book. And I can see it now. So that's thrilling.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is thrilling.
It's thrilling.
Do you find it disconcerting at all? I mean, do you find this kind of vertiginous relationship with the way that you read it previously? Or is it just a pleasant surprise?
No, it's great. It's more than that. It's nourishing.
Yeah.
Yeah. I feel as if I'm earning my life.
Mm-hmm. One other thing that I'm just going to ask you to react to, one more Calvino line. To read a great book for the first time in one's maturity is an extraordinary pleasure, different from, though one cannot say greater or lesser than, the pleasure of having read it in one's youth.
Yeah.
And he says, in a related way, whether we use the verb read or the verb reread is of little importance.
Yes, yes. Yeah, he's great that way.
Yeah.
You know, a great example of that experience was described by Edmund Wilson, who never read Uncle Tom's Cabin until he was quite mature and was so shocked. I had the same experience. I never read Uncle Tom's Cabin till a few years ago when I wrote a review for the Los Angeles Times book review. It was the 150th anniversary, and I read it for the first time. I was so shocked at how great a book it is. And we all thought we knew what Uncle Tom's Cabin is. I'm sure I made many references to it over the years without knowing what I was talking about. And he did, too. Well, it was an extraordinary experience in grown-up life to mm-hmm. read that book, which had been such a punchline throughout my life. And he wrote wonderfully about it, Patriotic Gore.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, Calvino has a line, too, somewhere about one's library should be composed half of books you've read and half of books you will read.
God, he said everything worth saying.
It's really a terrific.
Yeah, he's wonderful.
Kind of an amazing essay.
He's a wonderful writer.
I'm wondering how you would relate this book to the collection, your earlier collections, to The End of the Novel of Love and to The Men in My Life.
Oh. Well, I guess it's the same voice, sort of. It's the same person writing. They do all feel that they belong on a line. I think in each case, a set of books are collected in order to look at reading from a certain perspective. And then another collection, like The Men in My Life, represented for me a place that I got to finally where I felt immense sympathy for the depression that dogged the lives of all of these men. And I suddenly saw how noble it was that they kept on writing. And it was from that perspective that I wrote it. So that's a particular perspective mm-hmm. from which I wrote. And then The End of the Novel of Love speaks for itself. I didn't realize myself how much I'd written about that kind of thing until, again, I'm a writer who really needs an editor. a great editor, Deb Chasman, who runs the Boston Review. She was then an editor at Beacon Press. She put that book together, and she said to me, write an essay to that line, and mm-hmm. that's a book. And she was right, you know. In other words, reading is the constant. The way of seeing things, the things that grab your interest in a deep way, they determine the shape of each of these books. For me, they're all of a piece. I mean, I recognize myself in the writing of all of these books. Mm-hmm. I don't know how else to put it.
Yeah. Do you go back and reread your
Never.
Other books? So you're not really a chronic rereader.
Oh, I am of everybody else. No, never. I've never Googled myself, and I've never reread myself.
Receptivity is a major theme in the book, and it especially comes out in your account of Jail Carr and Pat Barker, and and the Doris Lessing, I think, as well.
Yeah, in a kind of
very funny way.
Yeah, receptivity is everything, and
it's such a mystery, too.
It is. It's astonishing. I think I put this in the Jail Carr part in Regeneration. I must have. It was Doris Grumbach, a critic who's, I guess, long dead now. She once wrote a piece I never forgot in which she reread a book she read some years before, and she wrote in order to chastise herself for having trashed this book 5 years ago. Now she picked it up, and she said, God, it's wonderful. How could I ever have done that?
Mm-hmm.
And she didn't go on, you know, beating herself. She just said, I guess I wasn't ready for it, which is the best way to look at it. But of course, that's what makes and breaks careers, lives, right?
Yeah.
The mood of the reviewer mm-hmm. at a given moment. She could have written that review very differently, and that writer might have had a different career. Who knows?
It's true. And there's also, I mean, there's all the mystery of it, too. It's almost like the book finds you rather than the other way around.
I should think so.
It's sitting there waiting for you.
I really think that. You read the books you need to when you need to.
I thought the Jail Carr was especially just... It's very moving, and I love you. You wrote at the end of the chapter where you discuss Carr and Pat Barker's book Regeneration. Sometimes I shiver when I think that I might not have reread either A Month in the Country or Regeneration, and then I shiver some more thinking of all the good books I wasn't in the mood to take in the first time I read them and never went back to. I don't mind if I've read only once a book that has left me prizing mediocrity. I can live with that. But the other way around, that feels oppressive. That is such great.
True. Isn't that true?
It really is. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, I think Carr, that book really deserves a readership.
Yeah. Oh, God, it really does.
It's one of those books, too, that how you remember what you remember about a book. I remember so very specific things about it. And then I wonder if there was a movie made out of it, I believe.
It was lousy.
Yeah, it was horrible. But I somehow can picture
that.
The English sunshine from that film in some kind of weird way and remember that. But now I have to go back and reread that book as well.
Yeah, it's a shame. That movie did absolutely not capture the atmosphere of that book at all. But you're right. You can feel the weather.
Mm-hmm. I'll say in the writing of this book, did you encounter or reread a book that you utterly lost faith in, not even of the Colette type, but even more severe, where it was just like, no.
If it came to that, I wouldn't have included it because, as W.H. Auden taught me a long time ago, it's pointless to write about bad art. There's no point to it except to establish your own smarts. I wouldn't do that. So when I did reread a book and felt nothing, I just let it go.
Mm-hmm. And the discussion also of Jude the Obscure is a really interesting one because it's the one book where you say, I think it's finally stopped talking to me.
Right. I just recently, a set of notes fell out of a book I took off my shelf that was about Sue Brighthead. These notes were about her. And I was shocked to see how long period of time it has been that she's been on my mind. And I saw it very differently than I do now. I mean, at that point, when I was writing those notes, there was nothing about her that irritated me. Now, she did irritate me, but on the other hand, the irritation was profitable. It made me see her in a light that was not dismissive.
There's a little story that you tell when you're discussing her where I think you're teaching an adult class and
some smart
ass. You call it a smart ass. Yeah. Said, why didn't she just get a job?
Why didn't she get a job? Yeah. Right.
Is any of the irritation with this book or irritation with books, how much do you count for that being social rather than somehow deep inside you?
The time in which it's being reread now, and do I give any credit to the responses of people I often want to dismiss, thinking they're ignorant or smartass or this? No, I've taught myself to try to slow down and listen and try to understand why. You know, it's all those years of teaching that make you sort of struggle to try to understand why a student is saying this. And if you hear it more than once, then you know there's something in the air for them. And I think I should try to, but I'm very intolerant. You know, I can't, I really, that's why I hate teaching. In this case and in other cases like it, I struggle to understand, is it the reader or is it the book that is bringing forth this moronic response? No, definitely. It's the times change. I change. The times change. The books change. I try to understand. I mean, not understand, but I try to include all that.
Do you still teach?
No. I hope never again.
I wanted to ask you about how much, when you're sort of working on this material, have you been a longtime keeper of journals about books? Have you kept a reading journal for years? Or were you using that as a resource or...
No.
I mean, you sound like you're also, like, your books are very well marked up, I would imagine. I get that impression, especially from the last chapter in the book.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
You've never been someone who...
No, no. But the books are on the shelf for years at a time. And every now and then I weed them out because I don't want to live, you know, drowning in books. Mm-hmm. And then I'm sometimes sorry I got rid of this one or that one, but mostly not, mostly not. So the books on the shelf are books that I... emotionally need to see on the shelf, mm-hmm. and or books that I consult from time to time that I know I'm going to look at again. And it's from those books that this collection came.
Yeah.
Every one of them has been on the shelf for years.
Before we go, I wanted to ask you about another book you have coming out, a reprint of The Romance of American Communism.
Yes.
That's amazing.
Couldn't agree more.
Can you say something about how that came to be? And
nobody's going to like hearing this. I really got talked into it. A wonderful editor at Verso, Jessie Kindig, she came to me and wanted very badly to republish this book. And I thought, no, why would anyone want to republish this book? And it's the book whose writing I most deplore of all the books of everything I've ever written. I've always felt it was rhetorical and over the top and emotional when it should have been analytic and all kinds of complaints I have about my own writing in this particular case. But I reread this book because I was really asked to. And I do have to say the stories that the old communists tell are still very moving. So whenever I let them speak for themselves, and most of the book, they are speaking for themselves, I sort of agreed that it was worth, perhaps it's worth seeing the light of day again. And then I've discovered since then that there are many, many young people who know of this book and are devoted to it. And that sort of shocked me. And I thought, there is something going on in the world that I'm not aware of. And they have multiplied, you know, since this project began. So we'll let the chips fall where they may. Yes, it's being republished in April, I think it is.
Okay.
And, you know, one of the worst experiences of my life were the reviews of this book. It was a nightmare. It really sent me to bed for a week.
Was it 1977?
70, yeah.
Okay.
Everyone was a trashing review. Every single one. You know, no matter who was writing and from what perspective. I was very naive. I didn't realize that in 1978, the issue was still as alive for many people as it had been in 1938, 48, 58. I was really naive about that. I just didn't realize it at all. Mm-hmm. It was the end of my apprenticeship in a certain way. After that book, I felt that the book received bad reviews because of the writing. I thought the writing just did not make terms. It was the end of my apprenticeship in that sense. I looked hard at it, and I saw that that was true, and I determined never again. And so,
it has a remarkable cult following.
It's unbelievable.
Yeah,
I don't know who they are.
I see it come up like every single day on someone's Twitter feed. That's
You're
exaggeration,
kidding.
But it comes up quite a bit. I saw someone.
What?
Trying to finagle a free copy out of someone, a PDF,
in
a Twitter feed by a very respected historian. I was surprised that he couldn't go on AB Books and find a copy.
I don't understand it. I think it has just sprung up since Trump got elected.
I think it is fairly recent, yeah.
I don't ever remember this, and I haven't heard any of it. I'm not on social media at all, so I don't know from anything that goes on there. But, you know, that's what Jesse told me, and Adam Schatz told me, and other people. And So, you know, I'm like the deceived wife, the last to know.
Well, on that note, thank you so much and congratulations on the book. And
thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, good.
This podcast was brought to you by the New York Institute for the Humanities at NYU and the Arthur L. Carter Journalism Institute. This episode was produced by Caitlin Nicholas. You can find us on Stitcher, iTunes, and anywhere else you get your podcasts. For more information, visit us at www.nyihumanities.org.